Welcome to another Muharatha from the top of the tent, better known as Ras Al Khaimah. In this monthly podcast, we chat about research, education, and arts in the UAE. I'm your host, Dr. Tiffany Lachelle Smith. Thanks for tuning in. Hayakum Allah. Before listening to this episode, I want to make a quick note that the conversation was a virtual conversation, so unfortunately, there's a few distortions throughout. However, the content is as amazing as Dr. Eloisa, so enjoy the conversation. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Eloisa Martin, who is the associate professor at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. She is the former associate professor at United Arab Emirates University, focusing on sociology of culture. And currently, she still holds an adjunct position at UAEU. Today on the podcast, we're going to be talking about her research project entitled Food and Culture in Ras Al Khaimah, Social Memory and Cultural Heritage in Emirati Domestic and Professional Kitchens. I am so excited, Dr. Eloisa. Welcome to Muharatha.
Thank you, Dr. Tiffany. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so we're going to jump right into it. Let's talk a little bit about where you're from and your educational experience.
Where are you from is always a tricky question for people living in the UAE. I can define myself as a global southern. I am an Argentinian living in Brazil who studied in Brazil and Argentina, but has a kind of global experience. I have been here and there and everywhere for my entire life and career, everything related with my own career. So, I mean, if I have to choose a passport, I will choose my Argentinian one. But I could say that my heart is in Brazil and I have friends all over the world. So it's a bit like that, being here and there.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about school because, I mean, your heart is in Brazil and you're still loving UAE. Where did you attend school?
I did my undergrad in sociology in University of Buenos Aires in Argentina. Okay. My master's I did in Federal University of Rio Grande do Sul, that is in the south of Brazil. In anthropology, my undergrad was in sociology. And my PhD, I did it in one of the most important universities in Latin America, and I will say in the world, is at the National Museum in Rio de Janeiro Federal University, which has formed many anthropologists working all over the world. So, and I was a researcher and visitor and lecturer, and I had been in Norway, in Berlin, in Asia, in Japan, Korea, China, Tanzania, South Africa, Mexico, Italy, all over. I guess it's about 27 countries.
Okay. You truly are a global citizen. And these are countries that you worked in or just countries that you visited?
And some of them, I've lived from, 1 to 3 to 6 months to a year or 2 years. In Germany, Berlin specifically, I've been there from 2012, almost every year. I could say that I most of the time I spent in Berlin, but from Berlin, I could go almost everywhere. So I have, spend time and teaching. I think that teaching, even if you are teaching for 2 weeks, it's a very, very intense experience when you visit another country.
I love even thinking about that. Say more, because I think one of the things, I don't have the experience. I do associate with universities, but being able to get into the classroom and work with the students or, professors, whoever it is, I can just imagine like the depth and energy of that experience. Talk about teaching in some of these countries.
Students are working with young generations are always a big challenge. First of all, because they change. So it's not the same young people 10, I mean, when you talk about young students or students 10 or 20 years ago that now, pre and post COVID, during COVID, of course, and they show you in a very particular way their own culture, from how they did respect or not the place of the lecturer or the professor, how much they value their education or not. I mean, it depends if there is, you have a classroom full of, you know, people from their own country, let's say from undergrads in Germany. I taught specifically to Germans, or in Brazil, they are mostly, I will say 99% Brazilians, or here in the UAE as well. I taught in the UAE, so almost all my students were locals. Then in other countries, when you have a very international group with their own tensions, if you have a gender segregated or a mixed class, and it's always a challenge because you are never prepared for what it came from. So it keeps you aware and awake all the time that you have been to be prepared for everything, from questions and be questioned to, you know, dealing with cultural situations that sometimes you are not prepared to deal with, but you have to, because you are in front of a classroom and you are the person with the responsibility to guide these students.
Wow, I love that. And the way that you describe it, I mean, it sounds complicated, but then at the same time, it sounds like, you know, you get a firsthand experience and being able to, you know, observe different ways of being, like you said, the value of education, you know, the culture and how cultures vary, you know, working with different students. It sounds very interesting, very interesting.
So then, yeah, it is. I mean, it's even with small things like the way that the students approach to you, how they believe or not that they are able to ask questions or not, or question the professors. In some culture, this is almost a no-no. Whatever the professor said, and that is, you know, sacred. And in other cultures, as for example in Argentina, you have to be very well prepared to be a professor, because students question you all the time, the entire time. So if you're not well prepared and you're not awake, really, they eat you alive.
I can say the same thing for America, and especially when it comes to undergraduate students. That's a group of young adults that I don't need. I don't need to be involved. Now, those graduate students are the ones that you can have those, you know, curious conversations or complex ideas, you know, where you're just kind of grappling. That's the group that I really enjoy. But kind of thinking, Dr. Eloisa, with the sociology, it sounds to me like even when you're engaging with these students, you're thinking about, you know, you're processing, you're analyzing even these engagements. So talk a little bit about how you came to sociology. Why is this something interesting to you?
It came out of curiosity since a very early age. It came from a very, very early age. Discovery that my brothers and I didn't have the same duties. So I have four brothers and different ages. I am the eldest. I noticed that while my brothers play, I have to help my mom with the chores of the house, do the groceries, or help with, you know, putting the table while my brothers are doing nothing. And the answer was, because you're a female, because you're a girl. And I found that very weird, because at that time I didn't understand the difference. I played with my brothers, and I mean, there was no such a princess. I was not educated as a princess whatsoever. But at the same time, I was asked to do the girl things. So since that moment, I was a really, really, you know, I was an observer. I like to observe. I remember myself observing the classroom when I was, 9, 10 years old. And I always like to read and write. So everyone, what do you want for your birthday? A book. So everyone gave me books. And at some point, My godmother gave me my first diary. That was a Hello Kitty diary, a pink one. A very nice diary that it has like a locker and everything and the key. And it was at the time that Argentina get into democracy. So I was very curious about elections. So I converted my diary in a certain kind of scrapbook with the candidates. I tried to explain what does it mean, so what was this party and the other. It was, I mean, I was something like Lisa Simpson style, very odd and very curious and very, you know, inconvenient at some point. but this is something that always happened all the time, trying to understand why the world worked in this way and not in the other ways. So sociology, I didn't know what that existed. Even when I was in school, we didn't have sociology as a discipline in high school. And I discovered it. I was in a very good high school. We have vocational support and vocational guidance. So we did a lot of tests and we read about this and that. And then I discovered that something like sociology existed. And I say, okay, this is what I wanted. I want to know how the clock works. I know that the clock gives me the hours, but how? And I had this kind of approach to society. I know that I should do this and that, but why or how? And why we cannot be different? And that's how I discovered sociology. And sociology is something that I tell my students in the first semester, you know, the freshmen and women, that I say, sociology it changed your life because it changed your mind.
Yeah.
So
I love that.
If you are not ready to change your mind and look to the world with the very different eyes that sometimes you are not even like it, it's better to find another. You go to political science, you go to anthropology because it's, you know, you study other populations, go to do communication, do other things, but don't do sociology because sociology is going to show you, you know, how society works. Mm-hmm. And many times it's not fair, it's not nice, and it's not what you would like to. But this is a good thing also to, you know, if you don't like how things work, to change them, to improve them, to
exactly.
Make life better for others and for your own as well. So,
yeah. Wow, that is a beautiful approach. You know, it's funny. Of course, I'm familiar with sociology, and I'm also in the social sciences. But when you're talking about like this clear view, asking your students, you know, if they're interested in sociology, because you are going to look at the world differently, you're going to, you know, have more questions and, you know, you're going to have different eyes. That is very, very true. Very true. I agree with that. How society works.
and you cannot leave it in the front of the house as you leave your shoes. I mean, it's impossible. At some point, you know, you say, okay, yes, you watch a movie. You can watch a movie and enjoy it. But back in your mind, you are thinking, this is really good to teach my student this and that. This is really good because they are showing these values. I mean, this is something that you cannot stop doing.
Exactly.
You even never though you, off. I mean, you cannot leave it. It's always this inner voice telling you, you know, you are seeing under the lines all the time, even if you don't want to. That's the challenge of being a sociologist.
And see, that's okay. So then let's go into a more focused area, which is the department that you were in at UAEU, Sociology of Culture. Talk a little bit about that and how it kind of pillars off from sociology.
I mean, I was hired to fill a position of Sociology of Culture in the Department of Sociology. So the whole idea of Sociology of Culture is as to put as an object of research everything that deals with culture. That could include from, you know, popular culture, let's say movies or series or cartoons or, you know, mangas or things like that, to higher culture, let's say opera or ballet or things like that, but everyday life as well. We consider culture in a wide way. So everyday life, everything what we do in everyday life, from how we drive, for example, how we, our bodies occupy the space, how we dress, what we eat, how we pray, to whom we pray, if we don't pray, how we write, how we express ourselves, everything could be analyzed toward its lenses. So it's a very big field of research. For many years, within this field, I was a sociologist of religion that it considered after many years a field in itself, because it has their own theories and their own methodologies, etc. But it's part of, also of sociology of culture. And well, when I moved to the UAE, I chose as my main object food, which is not very far from religion in many ways. First of all, because all religions have something with food. You have special dates, either that you fast or you celebrate it by eating some dishes or preparing to offer to God or goddess, depending on the culture, certain dishes to share. So food is always an important issue with when we talk about religion. But at the same time,
that's very and interesting. I never thought about that. You're absolutely right. The ways that we, I'll say, not celebrate religion, but engage religion is through food. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
And the other thing that I think is also is a bit deeper is that when I studied and researched religion for again 20 years, and I was working with the Catholic popular religion, and when I tried to understand what the devotees felt regarding the object of devotion, that could be a saint, that could be Jesus or the Virgin Mary or any other special entity, they say, okay, if you want to know the story, you just go to the priest or go to that, or they recommend me a book. And say, but yes, but what do you feel? I cannot explain what I feel. You have to feel it yourself. You have to try it yourself. You have to, you know, and it's complicated to, you know, try to get into the body and into the soul of someone else to try to understand what faith means, yeah, or what its faith feels like. With the food, it's a bit easier, but at the same time, it's the same. When I ask first time, how can you define Emirati food? Everyone from chefs to housewives told me you have to try it. I cannot explain.
Mm. Okay.
So is what I did. I cannot experiment, I cannot try other people's faith, but I can try other people's food. And in a process that took me, I won't say it's taking me time, it's still learning, but you start to learn what does it mean and what the food should taste and what it feels, what you eat, because again, you are eating, you are making, you know, you're putting that into your body. So you have sensations and you have feelings and you like or dislike, or you learn how to like. Because of course, as everything, not everything is, some foods are, you know, acquired tastes. So first time I tried Mishawi, I found it weird. Now I love it. So, but again, it's the way that you put, it's not just your brain. In sociology of culture, most of us are qualitative researchers. So we put our entire bodies into these situations. And when you research food, you really brings that into another level. And also you discuss with your own subjectivity again, because certain foods that you cannot like because your culture, you have to try because it's part of the hospitality. It's part of what you share with this culture that you are trying to explain. So you need to put your subjectivity and your own personal preference aside and try to understand the other in a very, very deep and sometimes difficult way.
So, Dr. Eloisa, as you're going into this, I think this is a great segue into talking a little bit about the social memory and the cultural heritage, because when you're thinking about, or at least when you're processing this idea of, food is not just tasting, it's immersing yourself in the culture, putting your preferences to the side, allowing yourself to learn different things. I think as the researcher, that's your experience, but when you're engaging with this project specifically with, Emiratis, what's coming up as far as that social memory and cultural heritage? And do they see food in the way that you're seeing it, as far as like, this comparison tangent with religion?
Let's put it in that way. What the sociologist sees and discover doesn't need to reflect exactly what the local population thinks or feel. Let's say my project is on Marathi food, but for locals, it's just food. It's not a Marathi. It's their food. As when I'm going to Argentina to eat at my mom's, I'm not eating Argentinian food. I'm eating my mother's food.
Very true.
And so, of course, if someone is going to try to explain or do a research on Argentinian food, I will talk about my mother's food or the food that I like or the food that I cook. That is food, no adjectives. So, what I'm looking at is how, as a sociologist, food helps to keep or change the social texture, the social network, the societies as a whole. Let's put it in this way. The questions that sociology brings are always of two kinds. First one is how social is either, how society might maintain itself in time. So why don't we are just individualistic ones, and why we accept the norms and which norms we accept and how the traditions perpetuate, etc. And the second question is how society changes on time, because society do both. It keeps
Exactly.
itself while changing. And fourth response to both questions. So, in terms of memory, when you talk when I did interviews and when I went to learn how to cook, this is one of the things that I did, not just eating, but how to prepare the plates, etc. You learn about, how the food is prepared now because you have a kitchen with certain appliances, you have certain ingredients available all the time, all year round, and then you have can choose the quality of your rice if you want to do mahbous, you use certain quality or certain brand. If you want white rice, you use a different brand. Certain things that are today are let's say everyday knowledge. But of course, and not 10 years ago, 20, 30, 50, 60 years ago was completely different. And this is why it's so important to look at food in the UAE because the pace UAE is changing
Yeah,
over time.
absolutely.
Absolutely. It's very fast. So there are gaps between generations that are very large. Between grandmothers and grandfathers are their mothers and fathers, and then daughters and sons. And both genders cook in different settings. Of course, the female women cook at the domestic setting. Male, in general, cook in the desert or when they are in the sea or when they are alone or where they are by their own with other males. But also to understand, of course, how Emiratis get into the professional setting and became chefs, both male and women. So observing how food had changed, what ingredients were available, also talk us about how the society network worked. You can imagine someone from the mountains that has to travel, 3, 4 days to reach the sea, in camel or in a honky, cannot bring fresh fish back home.
Exactly.
You need a certain way to preserve the fish in order to have it, in order to have it when the fish are not available because it was, very hot and in summer, and you cannot fish. You know, all these, they're very small things. They are very, very subtle in the way that the memory is constructed. But it's very neat, it's urgent, I will say. And then I am perhaps a little bit advancing in our conversation, in the sense that we need to be able to register the old recipes, the old communality, let's say, habits, in a sense, with whom you share the bread. Of course, the UAE and the Bedouin and the Arabic culture as a whole is very hospitable, is very open to the people who come home, and they give their best. But I mean, not everyone, despite of all of this, not everyone is really, really, really welcome, even though you give them the qahwa and the dates, you know?
Okay.
Exactly. So how it worked, how you organize, I mean, how it was, how were weddings in the past, for example, how were prepared, because weddings today are big events. So trying to understand how you create friendship and loyalty networks among women when you have to prepare a wedding. Not so many years ago, I'm talking about 20 or 30 years ago. You know, that shows you a certain type of society that is changing, that is not like that anymore, because of course the cities have grown, and you know, people move from one emirate to the other looking for a better job, and so on and so forth. Right. So considering that the UAE came from an oral tradition of keeping traditions, it's very important at some point to pay attention and register them. Exactly. Because of these generational gaps, I mean, it's not, just let me be clear on that. It's not the younger generation is ruined, as many people used like to say. It's not, it's there are gap generations among, I mean, among even, you know, 5 years between siblings. Because that is not the same in other countries. Why that? Exactly because the UAE is changing very fastly, and it is very future-oriented, right, let's say. And that is great, and they have done amazing things. But at the same time, if you don't stop for a minute and look at the past and keep that past and register that past, as Al-Khatimi Foundation have done with some, I saw some videos and some documentaries talking about, you know, how was the fishing and the pearl culture in the past, etc. Exactly. Well, food is fundamental. What do they eat? And this is important also to value the ancestors, you know, that they have very little and they did so much with that little. I think that Emirati food, one of the things that I found most incredible is that they are a very sophisticated cuisine, despite everyone say it is very simple, because they can make something really delicious with very little ingredients.
Yeah, so let's sit here for a second, because one of the things that I'm thinking about, as far as like the eating of the food, the preparing of the food, the socializing of the food, and then I'm going to circle back around to your suggestion as far as needing to register this information. But when I first was introduced to you, there was an invitation extended to come and experience this live demonstration where you and an Emirati chef were basically cooking together and talking about the food. You're saying that, you know, as far as the culture, you can make these very, very beautiful meals with very little. But based on your experience with the preparing and the live demonstrations of the food, talk a little bit about that experience.
First of all, the first surprise for everyone is that hummus is not Emirati. You know, yeah, it's okay. Not. I mean, we are not getting into that conflict. A very important element, let's say, to define or to circumscribe Emirati food that at the same time is very heterogeneous regarding, you know, the different landscapes, etc., is that it's completely different from the Levantine cuisine. The Levantine cuisine, they have another culture, another landscape, and different ingredients. Here in the Emirati food, you have like basic flavors that has to do with the bazaar, that every family has their own, every family construct their own flavors, spices, flavors that are a signature of a family. But at the same time, if you try several mahbous, let's say, from different families, you can say this is mahbous and this is Emirati, and it's clear, despite the taste, slightly different one from the other.
And Dr. So, Eloisa, when you say basic, what exactly is basic?
So one is the bazaar. The second thing is the lumi. That has another level of flavor that adds something that you cannot find anywhere. Because you say, okay, bazaar is like masala. Yeah, well, no. Yes, it's like a masala because masala is a mixture of spices, but it doesn't taste like masala. It tastes different because it has cardamom and saffron and other things. Then you have the lumi, that of course the lemon was cultivated here. You have registers of that in the 17th century, 18th century, in the oasis. They have these small lemons that you can find now dry, but they dried in the sun. You have two different. You have one that is like brownish, yellowish, and another one that is black. It's the same lemon. The black one is put into water and boiled, and then put into to dry. So the flavor is almost different. The black is a little bit bitter because you are cooking all the bitter parts of the lemon, and but they are the same fruit. And of course, visually they look different. That's not a minor thing, you know. It's like constructing two different flavors, two different looks, with a single fruit. That of course they are used also to make vinegar. I mean, lemon was a very important ingredient. And then, of course, the fat that is different from their Levantine cousins that used they have olive oil. Here you need to use animal fat. So. Samne or semen or ghee. So the clarified butter comes from the milk that you use for that. But of course, also for preserved meat, they have their techniques that use it with the fat of the animal as well. But for cooking, this is not used for cooking. It's just for preservation, the animal meat, the fat. But for cooking, I will say the bazaar, the lumi, and the ghee are basic. Without them, you don't have Marathi food. Emirates started to be able to buy more spices and to add the two more expensive spices of the world, that are cardamom and saffron. And of course, it has an impact on the food. Not every dish includes cardamom and saffron, but you know, it's also part of how traditions start to change once certain spices become more available and more affordable. Exactly. And also changed, for example, the flavor of the gahua. That originally, you know, the rose water and the saffron and the cardamom that nowadays are the basic spices that depending on the region you put on gahua, you couldn't find it. It was extremely expensive. Perhaps the sheikhs have them to use on some weddings or some special moments, but was not everyday life.
Yeah.
And so just a little bit, because this is something not even my Emirati students knew, and that's why I would like to say that gahwa was not made out of coffee in the past. It was made out of the date peat, dried and grinded.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. So, why that? Because coffee was extremely, extremely expensive. They didn't know that. I mean, but the grandmothers remember that.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Oh, my goodness. Wow.
So, the date culture, for example, and the importance of the date, not just as a fruit, but, I mean, the date tree and how the date tree sustain an entire is completely usable. It's one of the most sustainable vegetables, let's say, or trees that you can imagine, because you can eat the fruit, you can use the palm fronds to build a house. You don't even throw out pit of the fruit, because you can make gahua out of it. So, and I mean, again, it has to do with creativity. It has to do with how smart they were in order to do a beverage.
Exactly.
When, out of the date pit. That probably, I mean, I never tried it. I should try it once. I mean, because nowadays everyone prepares that with coffee. Mm-hmm. But probably tastes very, very nice as well. So, you know, all the things that, as I said, not even my UAE students knew that, it's not because they are not interested. It's because of this gap generations, because probably their mothers didn't know that.
Yeah,
because
it's not registered. Yeah.
Exactly.
Dr. Eloisa, wow, this is good. And it's always a pleasure to me, like kind of observing myself, especially when we're doing podcasts. Like if I am quiet, it's because I'm really, really interested. And just hearing about your study and you know, just the small things that you're giving us in this conversation, it is very, very interesting. So kind of talking about this gap, specifically with, you know, the younger generation not having this information because it's not registered, it's a perfect segue back to your finding, or at least your recommendation of ensuring that, you know, the food and the culture and the preparation, like that these things are documented and registered and available and maybe even included in schools. I know that a lot of cultural things are included in the curriculum, but I'm wondering if, for this last question, if we can talk a little bit about, you know, what are your ideas and hopes for this research, and how can we ensure that, you know, the registration of this, of the foods, of the culture, of the preparation is actually, you know, brought to life?
Well, first of all, I think that put food into the front, let's say, is an important thing for many levels, let's say, of policy making, because it covers from health to culture, through tourism and heritage, and, you know, it's, food is multidimensional. So people from different ministries, from different authorities could be interested in this research for different reasons. Yeah. Let's say from, you know, how to prepare traditional food in a healthier way, let's say using less fat or, you know, less salt. The one thing is that you don't need to use because you have a lot of spices, so in that sense, you know, it's good for the it's healthier. Or how to, you know, improve it or support the local entrepreneurs that wants to, you know, open or keep or improve their restaurants. And one thing important in Ras Al Khaimah that make it different from the other Emirates is that food is already there. Emirati food is already there as everyday life food. This is key. You don't need to, let's say, create a scenario to showcase some kind of authenticity, to say, no, this is really local traditional food. No, you go in Ras Al Khaimah, all Ras Al Khaimah, any restaurant will have a decent mahgous that you can eat on lunch time. Don't go in the evening to ask mahgous, because probably will be reheated, because rice is eaten at lunch, not at night. And this is one of the things you learn when you do fieldwork, is that, you know, these restaurants are following the local tradition of eating certain things in the morning, certain things in the for lunch, and certain things for dinner. And great fish with local seasoning everywhere.
Yeah, oh, I love that fish.
oh my God! And it doesn't need to say Emirati food. You just go and you sit in a regular restaurant and you will have the Emirati flavor.
Yeah.
In a way that you cannot find in, I will say, any other Emirates as they are in Ras Al Khaimah. Ras Al Khaimah is the place for the foodie crowd. Yeah. Not the Instagrammer crowd, that they don't want the fancy stuff, just they want what is real. And I think that Ras Al Khaimah has it all.
Wow.
Without doing any effort, it's there.
Exactly. And Dr. Eloisa,
It's just
what you're reminding me of is during our, and it's a good time to even mention this because we're preparing for the 2024 Rack Art Festival. And during the festival, it's one of our biggest events of the year. We offer a walking food tour. Now, when I've
Yes.
engaged in the food tour many times, but I've never thought of it as like an Emirati cuisine food tour. And as I'm thinking about, many of the things that you're saying, like, yeah, Ras Al Khaimah has plenty of restaurants that, it doesn't even have to be named Emirati cuisine because it's just part of the culture still. That's exactly what that food tour does. We go to different restaurants and we're eating many of, what can be described as Emirati foods. And it is a way to preserve the culture. But it's not even preservation because it's still so much part of the day-to-day.
Exactly. So it's, and that's why I say it's something that should be, in a sense, supported. What I saw from my last visit 2 years ago and the last visit last week was that there is a growing in the restaurants. There is a growing from, I mean, I remember I visit small cafeteria in Cass area. Very small, they work only for delivery or for, the rounding, honking situation. They have only one table. That's the one table where I had the interview with the owner, a young Marathi man that has a job in Abu Dhabi, but also wanted to have this business. And of course, they opened the business and then COVID came, but they know it was good because we did a lot of delivery and we learned a lot in the process. And I visited them last week and they have a beautiful, same place, exactly same place, but they bought something around an app and now they have a spectacularly beautiful cafe. So still keep on with the delivery, with the honking situation and everything. But if you want to go there and sit and have the food they serve, that is basically Emirati snacks, breads, and all the rest, you can go. But more interesting even is that this is not in a touristy area. You are not going there as a foreigner if you don't know that they exist. So they are catering, they're cater to Emirati population for the residential area around, So again, when we talk about the generational gap, is that probably mothers and or daughters are not interested, don't have the time or any other reasons to do the kebab or the hamir or the ragout for breakfast or for fuala, but they have a really nice place to buy it for home or to go there with the friends and enjoy a cup of tea or a karak or a gahwa with the local, very delicious, very well done Emirati breads, let's say. Same thing with another cafeteria. That one was in Iraq. That is funny because also started with as a small cafeteria, really in the middle of nowhere. It's nice in the middle of nowhere, but in a small spot over there, when they just people go with the cars and get their orders and eat in the parking lot. And then I just went to the same place to visit, and I said, "Well, this is not the same place." And I was very sad because I thought they failed. Because they were now selling hot dogs and things like that. I just walk around the corner, in this area that is Sand Street, not, it's the old part of Rack that has no that is sand, basically. And then I saw, this is a new restaurant. And then I took a picture. And I look at it on my Instagram because I have all the restaurants in my Instagram that also helped me as a book note. And I said, but I was following them. And then I discovered it was the old cafeteria.
Oh, good.
Exactly. And now it's a big restaurant.
So they
with a decoration that reminds one of the biggest brands of franchise of Emirati food. That was, I found it funny because I say, oh, you didn't need to put this like that. But anyways, I understand the intention behind it. And they became a restaurant. And I mean, I had a dinner with my colleague inside of the restaurant. Outside were full of local men having their meal and, you know, enjoying the winter, the marvelous winter weather. And I was so happy because it means something when this business starts to grow.
Exactly. And that it's a hit and that people are actually dining there. Wow, that's beautiful. Dr. Eloisa, we have to stop this conversation. We can keep going. This is really interesting. Yes. And I am looking forward to reading the policy paper and the recommendations. I also encourage the listeners, when the policy paper is published, to get a deeper understanding of the study and the findings on the website. So, Dr. Eloisa, I have got to say that it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast and speaking with you today. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Muharatha.
Thank you, Dr. Tiffany. It was the real pleasure to me to be able to share part of my discoveries and my journey, and to tell you that, you know, this research have changed my life in many different ways. I am very, very proud and happy and humble to be able to share my data and my findings with all of you. Thank you very much.
Muharatha is a podcast supported by the Sheikh Saud bin Sagar Al Qasimi Foundation for Policy Research. If you'd like to learn more about what we do in Ras Al Khaimah, visit our website at alqasimifoundation.com and LinkedIn. Also, be sure to follow us on IG at Al Qasimi Foundation.